The reading this morning is from Romans chapter 8, verses 31 to 39, more than conquerors. As you may be aware, in the previous part of the chapter, Paul was highlighting the frustrations caused by the turmoil and anxiety at trying to live through the complexities of our life. But as the chapter says, we are more than conquerors. What then shall we say in response to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also help, along with him, graciously give us all things? Who will bring any charge against those whom God has chosen? It is God who justifies. Who then is the one who condemns? No one. Christ Jesus, who died, more than that, who was raised to life, is at the right hand of God and is also interceding for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? As it is written, for your sake we face death all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord.
All right. I'm going to draw you back in. And I would like to invite Mick up, who's going to preach for us this morning. Thank you, Mick. We really appreciate you coming in and doing that. Thank you.
Thank you. Good.
Hello, friends. So Ruby and I have been coming here this year, but you've probably noticed that I'm the first out the door at the end of the service. Have you noticed that? Yes, you have. The reason being is that for almost five decades, I've been the last person to leave a room, be it a lecture room, be it a board room, be it a church or whatever. And I felt at the end of last year just to have an extended sabbatical this year. So, and that means for me doing ordinary time differently. So if I've, for most of my life, I've been out the door, the last person out the door, doing this year differently, I am the first person out the door. Do you get it? Yeah. So I just wanted to give you that little explanation. But it's so nice to be invited to speak here today. I was speaking to all day, actually, on Thursday, last Thursday, to the staff. And it's nice connecting. I didn't make it here last Sunday because I was speaking at St. Paul's Presbyterian. But I've listened to what Tim had to say via online. And so we've got this Narnia thing going, yes? And Tabea started out on the theme or motif of hope and shared how winter doesn't sit well with her. And then Tim, quite cleverly combined logic and imagination. Logic only gets us so far. Is that right, Tim? So I'm number three. And I thought the way I could begin is by sharing a true story. There was this young woman who at the age of 19 was set to be married. And then 3 days before her wedding, her fiancé ran off with the younger sister. True story. And of course, that rendered the older sister just feeling so hurt, humiliated, embarrassed, disappointed, depressed, You can name the overwhelming negative emotions, and understandably so. Over the years, the younger sister sought her elder sister out to express regret, you know, I'm sorry, and so on. But the older sister didn't want to have anything to do with it. Again, I would feel understandable. But then over the decades, and I'm talking 5 decades here, each and every time the younger sister wanted to make amends with the older sister, she was pushed away. And the older sister, initially in her life, she chose unforgiveness and bitterness. But over the decades, what she chose, she became. And she became unforgiveness. She became bitterness. In other words, initially it was decision, now it was her nature. And you know, when I heard that story, I thought, you know, what a shame. She didn't find her way to a local church. But then that's the plight of many people. This would be the last place. I'm not being disrespectful. But this local church would be the last place that people would come to. And you've got to ask the question, now, why would that be? And where I've got to, I mean, it's a number of things, but where I've got to is that there is a growing view amongst people that our God is Mr. Clean. And what do I mean by that? That our God is bald, large, and wears white clothes. And in heaven, this God has latex gloves on and bleach and disinfectant. And this God is forever scrubbing heaven to ensure that it's neat and tidy. And if God eats, he's got the right Tupperware in the fridge. And if God wears shoes, unlike our bishop, but if our God wears shoes, then there is a shoe organizer in the cupboard. And if there is a garage, it's spick and span. In other words, they have this view that our God is neat and tidy, that our God can't do dirt, can't do mess. What I would want to say that we can point people to Jesus, and more so his crucifixion. And we know what to be crucified is like. I mean, you're half dead, half alive, to make sure that the pain lasts as long as it can. This is how they did it. And your body is covered in dirt and blood, and the rats nibble at you on the cross, and the crows, they peck, and you are completely naked. So the cross is not just about violence, it's also about shame. So we have a God who can do dirt, who can do mess, and is not just Mr. Clean. But you see, have you noticed today that if you point to the crucifixion, there again is a growing view, and people will say, especially amongst the emerging younger generations, they will say, that's why I don't want to have anything to do with your Christianity, because of the violence. I mean, if at the heart of atonement is the cross, which I don't think it is, but if it's communicated that way, then people get an idea that, oh, okay, humans sin, God gets angry, and then looks for someone to punish. You know, if we mess up, this is a growing view. If we mess up, then someone has to die. Well, if that's what love looks like, count me out. And that is a growing view out there. You know, your God is abusive. Your God is tyrannical. Fancy having a God who kills his son. Are you with me? I would want to say, I mean, really, when you listen to this view, it's like God so hates the world that he killed his son. But of course, John 3:16 says the opposite. God so loved the world that he gave his son. In other words, nowhere in Paul's epistles or letters in the New Testament does it say that the crucifixion is about punishment. Nowhere does Paul say that God was punishing Jesus on the cross. Nowhere. Jesus himself said in John chapter 10, verse 38, that he went to the cross of his own accord. He said, "No one takes my life away, but I do this on my own accord." And then some people would want to say then, well, that's just madness. I mean, why would Jesus do that? Why would he go to that cross? Why would he do it? And that brings me to the topic of my message this morning. Why would Jesus do that? So Caleb approached me to do number three. And I said to him, well, what's the topic? And he said, atonement. Atonement. And I gulped. Because there's a lot of mystery attached to this. But of course, we're also sitting with C.S. Lewis. And C.S. Lewis sets the scene, doesn't he? Especially with Edmund. So there is Edmund, and he starts to fixate on Turkish delight. Doesn't he? Do you remember that? He starts to fixate, almost obsesses on Turkish delight. And by doing that, who is the giver of the Turkish delight? It's the White Witch. So he begins to come under the spell of the White Witch. He wants to stay near the White Witch because of the Turkish delight. And this kind of obsession with Turkish delight actually causes him to stumble. And he eventually betrays his siblings. And by doing so, he comes under more and more the influence and the authority of the White Witch. Now, in introducing Turkish delight, C.S. Lewis is doing something really important. He's saying that idolatry can be the ruin of us. See, where did it all start for Edmund? With the Turkish delight. That's where it started. And I mean, where did it finish in part? Well, because he betrayed his siblings, and he came under the authority of the White Witch, she demanded his life, of course. And then Aslan made his decision of his own accord to die instead of Edmund. And then, of course, we know what happened next. Aslan rose, came back to life. This is a Christ figure, Aslan. And who were the first two to see this resurrected Aslan? It was two girls. And who were the first to see the resurrected Jesus? It was the women, two women. So we can see what C.S. Lewis is doing here. And I just love the next scene where Aslan races off to the property of the witch and breathes on all the animals that have been reduced to stone. Oh, the breath of the resurrected Lord. But where did it all start? With Turkish delight. And you see, what C.S. Lewis is wanting to tell us is that part of the human condition is that we turn things into idols. Our hearts are idol factories. What we do, we humans are idol makers. We take things which are good and turn them into idols. We take things which are bad and turn them into idols. And they become too important in our lives. And we become dependent upon them. I mean, it could be like the sister. And it was an event in her life. And that event ran her life. And that event ruined her life. Because she gave herself to that event. She couldn't let it go. Became an idol. She obsessed about that event. And with Edmund, it was Turkish delight. With other people, it's money. With other people, it's their house. With other people, it's their clothes. It's their looks. I mean, we could go through the big long list, but you get the point. We so easily turn something into an idol. And it begins to control our lives, run our lives, ruin our lives. Now, our God in heaven, when he sees this happening, what does our God in heaven do? Well, our God in heaven takes responsibility. Our God in heaven takes initiative. Our God in heaven comes to a particular place at a particular time as a particular person, Jesus Christ. And then we see in this Jesus, his words, his deeds, his actions, what a beautiful human being looks like, idol free. And then, yes, this Jesus does go to the cross. And when we do give offense to God and give offense to others, Jesus absorbs that cost and doesn't require it of us. And then there is the triumph of the King in the resurrection. And this Jesus defeats death. Oh, but it doesn't even stop there, this word called atonement. And then Jesus ascends into heaven, and we're told in Romans 8 and Hebrews where he's interceding for you, for us. But it doesn't stop there. And then there will be that day, the return of the King. And this King will appear. And the curtain between earth and heaven will be lifted. And we will see the return of the King. And that King will create a new heaven and a new earth. Here. Here. And this earth will be infused with heaven. And we will live with him, but God with us forever. All of that is atonement. It's not just the cross. It's from the royal birth of Jesus to the return of the King. That is all the atoning work of Jesus. I think we've made too much of it about the cross. So people have this impression that it's all about killing and violence. I want you to imagine that you've messed up. Sooner or later, we all do. Be discouraged. Sooner or later, we all do. I mean, in our 20s, in our 30s, in our 40s, in our 50s, in different ways. In our 60s, for me, soon to be 70s. But we all mess up in different ways. We have little idols, big idols. I want you to imagine that you're at the bottom of a pit. You're sitting in there in your dirt and in your mess. Now, what does our Jesus do? Does he see the pit and do a runner? You know, get me out of here. I can't do dirt. No, he doesn't do that. So what does this Jesus do? Does he come to the edge of the hole or the pit and just stand there, you know, full of anger? No, I don't think so. Or does he get all judgy and wag the moral finger? And this is the impression sometimes churches give. Or does he pull out the Bible and start to give a lecture? Do you know what I mean? Or does he climb into the hole, get halfway down and think, yikes, this is too complex? No, I don't think so. What does this Jesus do? He goes down into the hole and he sits next to you and he says to you, are you ready? And you say, ready for what? And Jesus says, me. Are you ready for me? See, C.S. Lewis picked up on a point. In The Problem of Pain, he said, oh, all those theories of atonement, they do me no good. Now, I have a PhD in theology. So I think there's a place for atonement theories. But we are never asked to accept an atonement theory, and that will make all the difference in our lives. What we are asked to accept is me, Jesus. Are you ready? Ready for what? Me. C.S. Lewis brought this up in his book, Voyager of the Dawn Treader. You remember the story of Eustace Scrubb? Now, he made an idol in his life, and his idol was gold. So he had dragon thoughts, and he became increasingly this self-centered, selfish, greedy, dragon thoughts-filled person. And those decisions of his became his nature. And he became a dragon, Eustace Scrubb. And then after a while, Eustace, he didn't like being a dragon. So what Eustace thought, I'll undragon myself. So he started to tear at his dragon skin, but he couldn't get it to no avail. And then suddenly, a theory of atonement arrives. No. What suddenly arrives is Aslan. And what does Aslan do? With his lion claws, he starts to tear away at the dragon skin. Layer after layer. Oh, this is painful, yes, for Eustace. But he wants it. And finally, Aslan gets the dragon skin off. And he's covered in bruises, cut marks. And then Aslan picks him up and puts him in a well and cleans him. Baptism. But who did the life change work? Not a theory of atonement. It was Aslan, the Christ figure, Jesus. So friends, I've got to begin to wrap this up. It is truly amazing that in Jesus we have someone who can give us a quality of life before we die and a quality of life after we die. And history has served up no other person who can deliver on a quality of life before you die and a quality of life after you die. I mean, I like to tell the story of a particular cat in Indonesia. And this is true. This particular cat has very peculiar tastes and functions. And what it does, it goes to the coffee tree and picks out the exquisite beans, digests them, and then eventually what he's just eaten is exited. Is exited on the ground. Then the farmers come along. Have you heard this? The farmers come along and they scrape up the crap. Scrape it up, put it in a sack, and then they go back to the village and they roast what they've just picked up. And I'll tell you this, that coffee is considered to be the most expensive coffee in the world. It costs hundreds and hundreds of dollars per pound, and annually only 5,000 pounds of this stuff are available. It's called Kopi Luwak, It's called dung coffee. It's the most expensive. And this is what I hear in that story, which is true, that we have Jesus who can take the very worst and turn it into the very best. He can take the very worst memory that you've got. He can take the very worst hurt. He could take the very worst idol. He could take the very worst negative emotion. He can take the very worst and turn it into the very best. Isn't this amazing? And you think, how do we respond to this morning? I think the only response we can do is sing that final song, Amazing Grace. You think? So have a chat with the person next to you before we do that in terms of any thoughts on what I've shared this morning. Go to it.